What's something that works so well that it's basically magic? This time of year, I think of air conditioning. But selling with Shopify is also seamless. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling chess courses, merch, software services, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point-of-sale system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify's magic, which is your AI-powered all-star. When I was running an online teaching business, enabling seamless online payment saved me many hours of work and helped me focus on what I enjoy. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries use it, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. So if you sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/chess, that's all lowercase, shopify.com/chess, to sign up to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in growing it. Shopify.com/chess. We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. There's nothing sweeter than baking cookies during the holidays. With Prime, I get all my ingredients delivered right to my door, fast and free, no last-minute store trips needed. And of course, I blast my favorite holiday playlist on Amazon Music. It's the ultimate soundtrack for creating unforgettable memories. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are going to put a bow on a very entertaining world championship, and we have the absolutely perfect guest to do that, who I will introduce in a minute. First, minor programming note, I wanted to mention that I'm probably going to try to get this out a day or two early, but this is technically next week's episode, so the next regular Perpetual Chess will be on December 24th, although I may have a bonus pod relating to the World Rapid and Blitz, which I will be attending, and according to the internet, our guest will be attending as well. We will eventually discuss that. Also wanted to give a shout out to our sponsors, Chessable.com. The Woodpecker Method 2 has arriven or arrived. I'm not sure which. I bet Danya knows if it's arriven or arrived. I'll ask him eventually, but it's here. It's a great course. You can hear my interview with Axel Smith about it. And of course, if you sign up for Chessable Pro to access their many features, be sure to use the link in the description. So as for our guest, as you saw in the title, he is a popular and renowned YouTuber, 440,000 subs, Twitch streamer, commentator, author from back when he was a child, and he is just wrapping up as one of the lead commentators for chess.com's excellent coverage of the World Championship. Pleased to welcome back to the program Grandmaster Daniel Naroditsky. Welcome, Danya.
That was a pretty good introduction, Ben, but you missed pole dancer, violinist, let's see, night owl, you know, chef, sous chef extraordinaire. So you got almost all the titles. Thank you so much, Ben. Your podcast is amazing. Unlike most shows, you know, once they enter the seventh or eighth season, your guests are still amazing. It's an honor to be a guest on the podcast, and this is the best way I could imagine to put a bow on the world championship.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm glad to hear that I'm not going in like a lost like plot spiral where no one knows what's happening anymore and there's 20 different loose ends to tie up.
The plane is still flying. Okay. The plane is still flying. I'm sorry for half of my face is covered in sunlight. I might close the shades soon, but I've just seen so little sunlight because the show starts at 4 a.m. my time. And by the time, you know, the sun starts coming up at like 8, either the game was over or, you know, the day just begins and I'm going to sleep. So it's nice to feel the sun again.
Yeah, yeah. As we were saying before we recorded, it will be good after this interview for you to reacquaint with the world. But meanwhile, it's been obviously extremely entertaining world championship. Listeners, I'm sure you heard that Gukesh won in extremely dramatic fashion in game 14, a heartbreaking blunder from Ding late in the game. And that's kind of where I want to start, Danya. So you and your colleague, Grandmaster Peter Lecoq, had an amazing call. You know, you could feel the energy and feel the vibe shift when you spotted this exchange and this winning combination or sequence. It wasn't even really a combination after Ding's Rook F2 blunder. Could you take us inside that moment, Danya?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still taking myself sort of inside that moment. And, you know, first of all, congratulations to the new world champion. It's still sort of sinking in that, you know, you woke up yesterday. I don't know, the day before yesterday, all the days blurred together. Ding Liren was the world champion and now the youngest world champion in human history at 18 years old, which is something that I think chess players and chess fans have sort of gotten used to, that the ages of, first of all, grandmasters are getting younger and younger, and now the ages of world champions are getting younger and younger. Like, wait a second, at 18, I was like a freshman or a sophomore in college. I was like, I couldn't decide if I wanted to take intro to computer science or intro to linguistics. Like, this guy is winning the world championship of chess. It's really such a privilege. Like, I meant what I said at the end of the show. It's a great privilege to, you know, to commentate as we are seeing a shift and perhaps the beginning of a new dynasty in chess, or one could argue the continuation, but we'll get to that. As for Rook takes F2, I'm a bit of a contrarian and a bit of a grouch when it comes to like, criticizing the public reaction to certain things in chess. So beware. I'm going to get my pitchfork ready. Okay. So the moment itself, of course, was an absolute shock because there was a progression where at first, you know, the moment where the thought entered my mind that, wait a second, like this will not necessarily be a draw. There is a small inkling of a possibility that something unthinkable might happen was when Ding played A4. And like, Ben, when I reference moves, is that okay? Or should I try to keep it like
at a minimum, but certainly it can't be avoided sometimes. So
yeah.
Yeah. So that was a pawn. That was a pawn trade to simplify, to give white a pass pawn, basically.
Yeah. So en passant was forced, of course, only move. Just kidding. But in that case, it was the only reasonable move. And Ding liquidated into this two pawns versus three pawns endgame, which he thought was an easy hold. And, you know, most chess analysts would argue is a fairly easy hold for a GM. But there was absolutely no need to go into that. I mean, even before he was slightly better, you know, there were some higher level mistakes. But I was stunned that he didn't play bishop to d7, which would force the bishops off the board. And then the game would end immediately. Like, that was just the move to guarantee the draw. He kept the bishops on the board. Then he gave up a pawn and he wasn't able to exchange both pairs of rooks, which would essentially guarantee the draw. And suddenly, you know, when he started getting nervous and particularly eating into the extra time after move 40, you know, it sort of progressively dawned on me that, wait a second, like he might lose this game. And I even texted Robert at like 7:45, I think, which was maybe like 15. I don't know exactly when he made the blunder, but it was before he made the blunder that I think Ding is going to lose. Wow. It's hard to describe. And I don't want to sound like a, you know, like a Berkeley professor, or like a, you know, new age guru that like, you know, the energy on our call with Peter and just the energy kind of began to shift. You could feel that Ding was not just seeing ghosts, because suddenly the problems in his position became very real. And commentating with Lecoq is so amazing. You feel like you're exploring a cave that's so, you know, deep and dark, or you're in Mikhail Tal's deep dark forest where 2 + 2 = 5, except you're with the guy that's making 2 + 2 = 4. So he mentioned the possibility of Black's bishop landing on e4, and some of these rook endgames are either lost or borderline lost. And you're like, wait a second. Black actually has a concrete plan now. And I think over time, people begin to realize that, no, this is not just a fortress. Like, white has to defend by keeping the rook and bishop on the right squares. You know, it's a draw with a pretty wide margin, but it's much, much harder than it's been the entire game to hold the position. He's down to 10 minutes. So to me, and this is where my contrarian side comes in, like, the game was largely lost in the lead up to rook f2. Rook f2 was sort of the cherry on top, and this is how such endgames are often lost. Like, there's a buildup. Gukesh did an amazing job of squeezing out and posing problems in the lead up to rook f2. And then, of course, it was just stunning. Like, we mentioned rook f2 before he played it. And briefly in my mind, I didn't like the move, but not because I saw rook takes f2. I thought black could give a check on b1 and the rook shouldn't leave f4. Of course, the eval bar drops. And when it drops like that, it's just like a plane crash. You know there is something insane. And of course, that is a great aid in these moments, because it immediately makes you look at the concrete moves in a new light. There was a lot of discussion, Ben, and I'll end with this, on online about whether rook f2 was a basic blunder or not a basic blunder. And to me, it was all very confusing. Like, of course, rook f2 is a very basic blunder. Like, of course, like, any GM under any normal circumstances would never make such a move. But it doesn't make it any less understandable or ding any more worthy of criticism. Like, the pressure is unimaginable. Blunders are very common in the World Championship, and you don't need to, like, contort yourself and claim, oh, look, you know, Lekko and Danya didn't see it in 2 seconds. Therefore, it's actually like a GM-level blunder. Like, in fact, nobody would have seen rook takes f2. No, it's okay. Like, it doesn't make Gukesh's title any less worthy, the fact that this game ended with a blunder. The heavy lifting was done beforehand.
Well said. Yeah, and Danya, I always feel weird with grandmasters. Like, who am I to criticize them for making mistakes? But the one point I would highlight, and this is something I actually mentioned in my Chessable course, which is, like, you know, aim for players in the 1000 to 1500 level, is this idea that there's always an elevated chance of a blunder when you're making a transition specifically to a king and pawn endgame. And obviously, that's what happened. I guess maybe Ding just kind of forgot to calculate. Do you have any insight into what specifically he might have missed in offering this double trade?
Well, first of all, I will confirm from sort of the dark side of the moon. Having become a grandmaster, we don't, in fact, receive the how to not blunder kind of book once you make your third norm. It's not handed off from the heavens, you know, the 10 steps to never blundering as a GM. Like, I absolutely sometimes, even on stream, like, I will blunder my queen in one move. I'll blunder mate in one sometimes. And yes, it's very rare, but it'll happen. And my reaction is the same as, you know, anyone's reaction to one move. Like, oh, I didn't even see that that was hanging. Like, I didn't see the bishop was attacking the rook. And people, I think, sometimes are genuinely shocked. And it can be really cute to see, like, wait, you also hang your rook? Like, yes, I am also, in fact, human and prone to, you know, the absolute most beginner mistakes from time to time. It's just that the frequency is far less, but the blunders are never eliminated. And the same kind of visual errors and mental errors are prevalent among GMs and even world champions. So I think it's largely a matter, in the case of rook f2, of kind of making this assumption that a rook trade is always in white's favor. It's, you know, combine that with the rareness of this particular geometry. Like, how often do you see black playing bishop e4 to force a bishop trade? Okay, how often in general is white's bishop on the square a8? Like,
yeah.
If you think about it, if I do a game search for all my games with the white bishop on a8, I don't know if that's ever happened. So a lot of these, I would say in quotes, geometric blunders stem from the fact that, like, this construction is quite rare. And of course, like, GMs have this vaunted pattern recognition. That's why they can solve puzzles so fast. So the pattern recognition doesn't really kick in. And combine that with the fact that a rook trade favors white under any normal circumstances. I was proud of the fact that with Peter, I did mention that without the f pawn, that pawn endgame can be winning for black if black has the opposition. Of course, in the position where the bishops were traded, you do need the f pawn, otherwise it is a draw. But yeah, I mean, the blunder itself is totally understandable to me. It's a little bit strange that he kind of, obviously, he made mistakes along the way to make his task more and more narrow and more ditzky. I've made that point many times. But yeah, I think it's the fact that the geometry of bishop e4 is quite rare. And, you know, Gukesh claimed that he didn't see it immediately. I think maybe he played it up a little bit for the crowd, and he was just so gracious in general. I think by his body language, it did take him maybe a second or two, but yeah, he saw it very quickly.
Yeah, unforgettable body language from both players. That is something that's going to be etched in my mind for a long time, seeing Gukesh struggle to control his emotions and make sure he does his due diligence. And then that crushing moment when Ding notices, you know, obviously you, in theory, as a chess player, you don't want to give off that you missed something, but Ding kind of knew the jig was up and just couldn't control it. Just unforgettable.
On the show, I said I couldn't decide if I wanted, because I had, you know, goosebumps, and I didn't know whether to say I have goosebumps on my skin or butterflies in my stomach. So I think I said butterflies on my skin.
You did say that.
Like, in that moment, it's just, you are at a loss for words, because nothing I say, and you know, I don't want to get too off topic, but one of the most impactful, the things that impacted my commentary style the most is JJ Redick, the current coach of the Lakers. And I'm a big basketball fan, that also impacted my commentary style. He used to do a podcast, and he did a podcast episode with Mike Breen, who's one of my favorite basketball commentators. And one of the things Mike Breen said that really stuck with me is JJ Redick asked him, like, what is it like to cover the big moments, you know, the buzzer beaters and the end of an NBA Finals game? And Mike Breen said something along the lines of, let the big moments breathe,
Yeah. Because
the big moments speak for themselves. Like, when there's a buzzer beater, you often hear, sometimes you hear the commentator going crazy and it's great, but sometimes you hear nothing, and that can be, you know, deafening silence. In that moment, like, Gukesh's tears, the raw emotions, and Peter made me stay on track and watch the moves happen, which is awesome, because I was about to, like, delve into irrelevant analysis, as usual. But that was really powerful, and I was actually really happy that we stepped off the gas pedal. That moment very much spoke for itself. You didn't need, you know, some commentator's annoying voice overlaid on it forever when people watch it, you know, 5 years later.
Yeah, the chess spoke for itself, for sure.
Dude, I feel like everything's a meme now. Like, interesting move, meme. Yeah. Speak for itself, meme. Procedure, meme. Like, do these people, like, own the English language now?
There's no unturned phrases.
Ooh, are you, like, implying? I even said once, and I try not to, like, involve myself too much with the crowd reaction, but it's too funny. I said something like, you know, Lecco made this joke at first. He's like, oh, start your engines or something, but not literally. And I said, and Gukesh will play queen h5 and he'll have a kingside attack. He'll start his engines on the kingside. And then someone's like, do you see a subtle accusation there by Daniel? It's like, dude, like, I'm just right. Can I no longer make a joke?
Yeah. All right. Well, returning to that moment, Danya, so that was really insightful what you said about what you heard from Mike Breen. And I've noticed that in some of the iconic sports calls that you can find on YouTube. But I wonder, as someone who's gotten to call so many historic events, but obviously this being at the top of the list, like, as the game, as you start to think about Ding losing, are you in the back of your mind thinking about, like, what's going to happen if such a moment happens? Do you practice it before you're commentating? Could you lift the curtain on that?
Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately, and probably I should sort of do the equivalent of looking at film. And I do that to some extent, just for the future. Is it okay to cuss, or you prefer that I don't?
You're okay. I'll click the little box for it. Yeah.
Okay, I won't swear like a sailor, make you, you know, go through the whole video and edit out all these moments. But in short, I do get feedback on sort of a high level from the production team. And of course, like, I read feedback online on Reddit and elsewhere. I know people will be like, oh, you know, why are you looking at Reddit? Why are you looking at YouTube? But it is important, because I commentate first and foremost. Well, I love commentary, but it's for the fans. You know, the fans make the moments special, because I know that there are people on the other end who are watching this and taking it in. And that's why I consider it a great honor, because there's just so many people who kind of invite me into their homes, figuratively speaking, of course, or their cars, or, you know, their airplanes, or wherever they're watching from. And I get to be in on those moments. I don't really practice, like, the big moments in the shower kind of thing, but I do think it through. And I try to change my commentary at a higher level when I get kind of a consistent piece of feedback. And, you know, this Mike Breen thing that I mentioned, I think it was part of a larger habit that I had of sort of being a little bit overzealous, particularly as big changes were happening. And the problem is, just like with, like, an exclamation mark in essay writing, if you use too many of them and every sentence has an exclamation mark, you know, you're going to like lose your voice. So you need to reserve the super high energy commentary style for the moments that truly deserve it. And understating, I think, is much, much better than yelling and blowing out the mic when, you know, like there's a slight inaccuracy. Because if I parroted the chat, what it would sound like. Oh, huge blunder, like eval bar drops from 0.2 to 0.4. Oh, it's back to 0.2 again when the stockfish depth goes up by one. So that's been sort of the main thing that I've really told myself to do is it's okay to let the car coast on itself, on its own, because contrary to the narrative, I think in these big moments, even in classical chess, everyone's already at the edge of their seat. Like you don't really need to work that hard to add excitement levels, so have a pretty easy job.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's zoom out a little and talk big picture about the match. So obviously a lot of people going in, Danya, did not expect it to be this nail biting. And there were some other surprises along the way as well. How did it conform to your expectations?
Well, first of
all, I know you're a team anti-prediction.
I'm a prediction hater. You know, yeah. I'm a huge prediction, known prediction hater, card carrying, you know. And I like predictions in other sports. It's not like I'm in, you know, the Nostradamus hating society or something. Even though Nostradamus himself is a historical figure, is kind of overrated. You know, like, oh, an event will happen in the year 2000. You know, oh, Nostradamus predicted this. You know, Nostradamus predicted 9/11. Like he said, some bird will fly somewhere. It's like if we make them general enough,
right?
Everything can be considered a prediction. And the reason in general that I kind of it's everything's a meme in the chess world, right? Everything's memeified. But to me, it's like people think that grandmasters have a look behind the curtain and so can make more informed predictions. Plus it's fun. But the reality is my guess is as good as yours. Like, I don't know, let's say in this case, Ding or Gukesh even personally. I'm not like more acquainted with their games or their habits or their styles than the average, the average Ben is. And you're probably more acquainted with it, with their games than I am. Like, of course, I try to do my due diligence before a big show and I do some research on their high level stats. But of course, like Gukesh was the favorite and I acknowledged that. And that was borne out by the evidence. Like Ding was really struggling in the lead up to the world championship. But I tried to emphasize that he did show signs of improvement. Like the Olympiad, from one paradigm, can be considered just another bad event, right? He didn't win a single game. He wasn't playing for Team China in the big moments. On the other hand, like as I said back then, because I did cover the Olympiad, the bones were there. Like finally you saw Ding like consistently starting to outplay really good players. In the Sinkfield Cup, he was also like close to beating Gukesh, and he was close to beating Wesley. And he started to show better opening prep. So like compared to some of the car crash events earlier, it was a pretty big sort of sign of life. And so to me, the question was like, can he complete this psychological transformation given the fact that by and large, Gukesh is playing his first world championship match. The pressure on the 18-year-old is insane. Like I really admire the way that Gukesh handled the pressure. And I feel like this has become somewhat of a cliche. But like, come on, like the entire country of India in a very positive way is rooting for you, but that does create a lot of pressure. You're considered the favorite having never played a match before and you're the challenger. So it's like, obviously that's going to probably have some sort of impact on Gukesh. And I think Ding's team must have told him that like, look, yeah, you've been struggling. That's okay. But remember, like the pressure is on Gukesh. You're not necessarily the favorite. So to me, it was not clear that it was going to be a blowout. And, you know, I was trying not to say some things that people would think of me as like Skip Bayless or, you know, have me in the Stephen A. Smith terrible prediction call. It's going to be a 5-point blowout. In fact, like Gukesh is going to win all 10 games. They're not even going to reach game 12 or whatever, or game 14. No, like I did not think it was likely to be a total blowout. I thought that it was likely to be like a 2 or 3 point match. But when Ding won the first game, like everybody shut up real quick,
right?
Real quickly. And suddenly, wait a second, like Gukesh is no longer the favorite. Like two seconds ago, you were singing a very different tune.
Yeah, it's just hard to know. I mean, we all knew that Ding had it in him to reach that level. But even as the match unfolded, Ding's weak moments were kind of what we feared. It's just maybe they came a bit later and they were less frequent than we feared. It's, you know, there was an interesting tweet from Grandmaster Jonathan Rowson And Magnus and Levy in their must watch recaps kind of highlighted this sort of, as you alluded to, sort of slow unraveling in game 14 in particular, where he had easy draws in his grasp and then kind of went for this end game where he was defending. And Jonathan Rowson wrote, "Congratulations to Gukesh, world chess champion. Things play in the final game, particularly the decisive blunder, looks like sublimated self-care. He's a warrior poet, but I believe at least part of him wanted to lose. This part of his psyche took control at the end." You think that's too much psychoanalyzing? Because it resonated with me.
No, it honestly resonated. And I want to be very, very careful here in like what exactly like I'm claiming or agreeing with. First of all, I'm a big fan of Grandmaster Rowson. He's got two books on chess psychology, Seven Deadly Chess Sins and Chess for Zebras. Ignore Fantastic. The title.
Asterisk, yeah.
That I think are just, you really put it down and you go, wow. Like, yeah. They make you think. And I'm just pulling up the game so that, because I'm so bad at remembering what happened in what game.
I think okay, people listening would find that. Oh yeah. It's separating which game is which. Yeah. I mean, this was after game 14 that he said this.
The final game. And game 11 was the one where Ding played queen c8 and blundered the piece. By the way, I have the same exact slight criticism or maybe a nudge for fans not to, like, recency bias is a huge thing on many fronts in chess. But it's a thing with blunders, too. By the time queen c8 was played, Ding is down to 741 minutes for 12 moves. And I think the game was, like, lost much earlier, actually. Yeah, the blunder was shocking. 11. Yeah, game 11.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be, like, the contrarian, the party pooper, and say, you know, like, the blunder didn't decide anything. Like, of course, the blunder was shocking. You know, you don't blunder a piece in one move often in the World Championship. But the pressure by that point, to me, was insurmountable. And Gukesh was up 6 minutes on the clock. So post factum, I think it's very important to look at things through a slightly more fine grained lens. And to address like Grandmaster Rowson's point. Yeah. Ding mentioned in the press conference that, and he was also, you know, so gracious. I really, my heart went out for him, that there's no game tomorrow and he's really happy about that. And like, I almost teared up at several points in that post game mode, cause there were just so many emotions and I feel like I've had the great privilege of sitting there and watching all this unfold and the payoff was tremendous. Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging that for Ding, he struggled with a lot of mental health issues. I hope the chess community can like unite in wishing him well. And one positive is that maybe with this burden off his back, like he can actually focus on kind of redeveloping and reigniting a love for chess. And if he wants to step away from the game, then that's his right. And the most important thing is to preserve your health. You know, I think a lot of chess fans like have been very kind to him, but it's also important not to infantilize Ding. You know, he has ascended to the very peak of chess. And I this is a separate topic. I'm not going to go on the soapbox for too long on this front, but I feel like there's a little bit of that infantilization, weird kind of infantilization going on. And too much like ice cream. Oh, like, you know, what's his favorite ice cream flavor? And like, oh, we got him this kind of ice cream. Like, this is the world champion. He's an adult. He's fully aware of what's going on. And there is, I feel like saying that for Ding, maybe like not having the burden of this title, there is a positive in that. And certainly like he may be like excited and happy that he finally gets some time to chill in the non-ironic sense. is a good thing. Saying that in no way minimizes Gukesh's effort or, you know, disqualifies his title. Like, it's crazy to me how sometimes people think that one thing implies the other and it really, really doesn't. So I do agree with Jonathan Rowson, and I hope that we'll see Ding back at 2800. And I remember reading somewhere from Tigran Petrosian's wife in some memoir that when Tigran Petrosian won the world title, he had something very similar happen where she had to beg him to defend the title.
Right.
Because like the burden of the title cannot be overstated. You think, it's amazing. You've ascended to the peak. Life is great. But the burden of having to start the engines again, non-ironically, and start preparing for another match and having to face the prospect of being a defeated world champion, that's daunting. That's you know, tremendously hard to handle from a mental health standpoint. And Ding is far from the first player to deal with some of those issues on top of everything else that he's already been facing. All things considered, he did a great job in the match.
Yeah. And I thought that it also he was so, I mean, as you say, the emotions were overwhelming at time coming from both players, but he was so sportsmanlike when he said after game 14 that he felt like maybe it was a just result since Gukesh had so many chances previously. I mean, you don't hear that very often. And to your other point, Lawrence Trent, also tweeted something along those lines. He said, losing the title is the best thing that could have happened to Ding. Like Spassky, the burden of the crown was overwhelming, and I think he'll now be able to heal and get back to the level we know he can play at. And I was excited to see he's already talking about trying to qualify for the next candidates. So
yeah. I mean, I would love to see Ding back at the top of Chess Olympus. And I'm super excited to see who Gukesh will play in the next. Like, I can't wait for the next match.
You're already Fabi's got the lead on Eric Gaethje for the first spot. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Fabi's playing in Charlotte. And wait a second. Why is he playing in Charlotte to qualify for the Canadas? Why is he playing in the Canadas? Oh, he wants to challenge Gukesh. Imagine Gukesh Caruana. Like, oh my God, that would be incredible.
Yeah.
Because and first and foremost, I am a fan. Like, as a commentator, you have to be a fan of the sport and a fan of the top players. I love Gukesh. I think he's super high quality person, and also just I'm excited to watch his play evolve. Like, people forget what it means to, they get annoyed when like a commentator keeps repeating that he's 18 years old, but why is it worth repeating? Because you evolve as a person. Like, he's not done, his brain is not done changing. It's like prefrontal cortex is going to grow, and presumably his style will change, and you know, new challengers will ascend to the throne, or will try to ascend to the throne, and he'll try to stop them. And I'm excited to see if Fabi can make another go at it. The next candidates tournament is going to be another dogfight. And this is what creates the cycle of hype in chess. It's like, okay, we got a new world champion, Magnus. Maybe he wants to, give it a shot. Maybe, just maybe, we'll see something like that. Maybe he'll be more motivated once again. No, it's awesome. And I'm excited to see what happens next.
Yeah, we can dream, but Magnus was already downplaying the chances of him reemerging on the take post game, unfortunately, but still plenty to be excited for. And
hey, that Magnus hype train really will take off pretty soon, I believe.
Well played. Returning to the emotion, I felt more emotion watching this than some other world championships. I was trying to think about why that might be, and I think part of it might be this dichotomy with Gukesh of him being so tight-lipped generally. Obviously a wonderful, unbelievably mature 18-year-old, but obviously very sort of tight-lipped and controlled. And then the moment got to him. And I think that was so relatable. And then you have the moment of him hugging his father. For any listeners who haven't seen all this stuff, I definitely recommend going to like chess.com shorts and Chessbase India shorts and just checking out their videos. We'll be right back with more World Championship Talk with Grandmaster Daniel Naroditsky.
We have one more act for you this evening. I don't even need to say his name. Mr. Bob Dylan.
From the director of Walk the Line and Ford vs. Ferrari.
If anyone is going to hold your attention on stage, you have to kind of be a freak.
And starring Timothée Chalamet as Bob Dylan.
Are you a freak?
Hope so. Once upon
a time, you're just so fine. Inspired by the true story.
I want to know which side he's on. Then
you. This Christmas.
They just want me singing Blowing in the Wind for the rest of my life.
Bobby, what do you want to be?
Whatever it is, they don't want me to be. How does it
feel? He defied everyone.
Turn it down!
Play loud!
To change everything.
He's our Elvis.
With no direction.
Timothée Chalamet, Edward Norton, Elle Fanning, Monica Barbaro.
Make some noise, BD. Track some mud on a carpet.
A complete unknown. Only in theaters Christmas Day. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent.
What if you could hear your favorite song for the first time again? Introducing the all-new, reimagined Nissan Kicks. With an available Bose Personal Plus sound system that uses speakers in the headrest to create a 360-degree listening experience. You've never heard anything like this. Reimagine your music and your drive. Experience the all-new, reimagined Nissan Kicks for yourself at NissanUSA.com today.
Available feature. Bose is a registered trademark of the Bose Corporation.
The number one selling product of its kind with over 20 years of research and innovation. Botox Cosmetic, onabotulinum toxin A, is a prescription medicine used to temporarily make moderate to severe frown lines, crow's feet, and forehead lines look better in adults.
Effects of Botox Cosmetic may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away as difficulties swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness may be a sign of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Don't receive Botox Cosmetic if you have a skin infection. Side effects may include allergic reactions, injection site pain, headache, eyebrow and eyelid drooping, and eyelid swelling. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Tell your doctor about medical history, muscle or nerve conditions including ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis, or Lambert-Eaton syndrome and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects. For full safety information, visit BotoxCosmetic.com or call 877-351-0300.
See for yourself at BotoxCosmetic.com.
But, Danya, do you think that this World Championship had more sort of heightened moments of emotion than prior ones, or is it just me?
No, it's definitely not just you. I felt that too. And what I liked is that it wasn't really manufactured emotion. I think that discerning fans are very sensitive, and rightfully so, to sort of artificially superimposed emotion, if that makes sense. But here, The emotion was 100% genuine, and really you didn't need to manufacture anything. Even like the camera views of the players, like furiously, you know, wolfing down the snacks after move 40 to gather the energy to return to the battlefield. And then, of course, like the sights of Gukesh's father pacing around furiously with his phone. It's so relatable because of all the World Championship matches that I played in. No, just kidding. Because like my parents, and I know my mom, I'll send her that clip because she'll find that unbelievably relatable just watching your kid's game and not knowing, you know, here, like I cannot even imagine what Gukesh's parents must have gone through. And then the spill out of emotion, like the payoff of the drop, the moment happening, the result being the handshake happening and the signatures being put on the score sheet. And finally, it's official. No, it's amazing. And of course, you knew that as the favorite, as someone with like an entire country to support you, Gukesh, like he kept it all bottled in and buttoned up. But when he actually wins the title, seeing the reaction of all the fans, from the Chess Base India show, like, you know how much it meant to each and every one of those fans. And again, like, it's all very genuine, pure emotion. You know, both of these players had a lot of fans. I feel like there was so much talk of like, how accurate was this World Championship match? Like, does this really show that Gukesh is the best player in the world? Like, again, there's no need to like infantilize the discussion. Like, nobody's saying Magnus is worse than Gukesh, and Gukesh himself is the first to acknowledge that, but it doesn't make the match uninteresting or insignificant. And again, I'm so excited to see how Gukesh's play will evolve. And, you know, one of the things about him that I find most impressive is just his work ethic. I was asking Ramesh, RB Ramesh, who was teaching a camp in Charlotte this past summer, a little bit about Gukesh, like if he could pull back the curtain a little. And of course, like he can't reveal, you know, I wasn't asking him to send me his chess base files,
right?
Which would be nice, but I wouldn't have that expectation. And he was saying that, you know, he can't reveal a lot, but Gukesh is a pretty solitary guy, and it's not a facade. Like, he lives with his parents, you know, he truly is driven by a love for chess. And he's a quiet dude. Like, he lets his moves do the talking, or speak for themselves, I should say. And I think that people really value the genuineness of the emotion and the genuineness of both players' love for the game. I think we need a lot more of that in the chess world. And it's a nice change from some of the ups and downs and drama that has seemed to dominate the chess headlines. At least for me, it's a great relief to see some of that positive energy replacing some of the not so positive energy of the last few months.
Yeah. And A-plus story writing that Gukesh, like when he was 7, said he wanted to be the world champion. He describes this moment of watching.
Of course, they found the clip. Of course, that clip existed.
Yeah, exactly. Watching Anand and Carlson in the glass box and thinking he'd like to be in that glass box someday. It's just, you couldn't write a better script. So it was fantastic to see.
It's tied into the final game. Like, come on. Steven Spielberg must have been watching that match. Like, given some of the quality of some of the recent movies, like I think some of the movie directors really should take a cue from from the arc of the World Championship and Gukesh's arc in general.
Exactly. Yeah, maybe we can have this as the positive chess fiction follow-up we've been waiting for Queen's Gambit, because it is like just a fairy tale so far. And to your point, I mean, Gukesh, very sportsmanlike that he said, of course, Magnus is the best player, and also inspiring that he said he still wants to get to that level. You know, he's not complacent by any means. So exciting to have him looking to get back on the grind. And obviously, in addition to the aforementioned Caruana, young, hungry challengers like Irigesi and Abdusatarov, and the even younger than that generation and so many more should be pretty entertaining, which brings me to the next sort of minor topic. So I mentioned the Take, Take, Take recaps. Obviously, having Magnus cover it is a special treat to my mind. But I did notice a few strains of criticism at the aforementioned Chess Reddit. Grandmaster Daniil Dubov also did a really interesting interview with the New in Chess podcast. And one thing that Dubov said that I found provocative, if nothing else, was he felt like maybe...
Dubov said something provocative? Are you sure you got the right name? No, just kidding. Go on.
He felt like maybe it's a little too much to have Magnus weighing in every day. Like, it impacts the discourse so heavily. Do you agree with that at all?
Yeah. Do I have any takes on Magnus's takes? God, this is sometimes when there's like an endless source of puns, it's like, I cannot help it. It's funny. I actually, as a quick aside, the pre-penultimate round, game 12, I did. I actually did commentate in Russian. I promised my friend Max Omariev, who heads the largest Russian chess YouTube channel, and we'd done like a 2-hour podcast in darker times. He really helped me out, and he was on my side. And I promised him at least one round. So, despite being at the grade level nationals in DC, we drove back at night, and I stuck to my word. And it was sort of a very chill broadcast. Like, it wasn't super official. I was commentating with Matvei Galchenko, who's an IM, who also has been on the receiving end of certain procedural topics, shall we say. But it was super, super fun. And at one point, we were joined by a young Russian GM, Sava Vatokhin. And Sava, S-A-V-A in Russian, means owl. So that was yet another like endless source of puns, because of course, first thing I tell him is like, are you a morning person? But that would be weird. I assume you're a night owl. And if we're night owl in Russian, is the same phrase. And then I asked him, como sava? Como sava? Yeah. So like, I love it when there's some name that you can use for puns. It's great. Okay. What were we talking about? Oh yeah. Magnus's
takes. Takes. Yeah.
So first of all, to set the historical context, I feel like recaps are nothing new. And like, the crowd's kind of obsession with recapping world championship games is not new. And what's interesting is, I mean, I love researching old world championship matches. And for like the early matches, even like 1886, the first world championship match between Steinitz and Zukertort, 1894, which is when Lasker deposed Wilhelm Steinitz, you can notice like the same kind of obsession with recaps. And what form does that take? Of course, like the 19th century equivalent of recaps, which is that like all of the newspapers had to cover the game and they had to hire someone good to annotate it. And so there was like a glut of different players, including the players themselves, annotating the game ASAP. And for example, for the Lasker match, Lasker annotated the games, and then Harry Nelson Pillsbury, the top American player, was contracted by some of the local newspapers to provide his annotation. And then, of course, Steinitz had his International Chess magazine. So how could he miss the opportunity to commentate the game? So one of the great articles on the match online has all three of them commentating superimposed on each other. Does that sound familiar? It's like Geert recapping, Magnus is recapping. And there's a funny moment, actually, that I stumbled upon, which is Lasker was the first player in chess history to play a French in a world championship match. He played it in game 8, and I think he won that game. Yep. Does that sound familiar? So there's all these interesting parallels in chess. But what's cool is, okay, e4, e6, d4, d5, Steinitz played knight c3, and Lasker plays d takes e4, which back then, this is now known as the Rubinstein variation. Back then, it was not such a common move. And so Pillsbury's annotation to this move is, the line of play initiated on Black's third and fourth moves, d takes e4, knight takes e4, knight d7. Is the invention of Mr. Robinson, a prominent Philadelphia player. But Steinitz writes, of course, he's the European, even though he was living in the U.S. at the time, first brought into public notice by the late J.H. Bauer in a local tournament in Vienna. He's like, no, this was the European invention. No, this is invented in Philadelphia. Yeah. Actually, Bauer is a pretty known name. Christian Bauer is a modern GM, but Bauer also was on the receiving end of the famous double bishop sacrifice by who? By Lasker.
Yeah,
classic. Himself. So you get into all these like interesting little tidbits when you study the history. So I have a funny story about Pillsbury that I'll save for later in the podcast, maybe. As for the recaps, yeah, you know, Magnus obviously dominates the chess discourse because in the chess world, like nowhere else, there is such a clear hierarchy because there is a clear top player. There's a clear player who, when he offers a take, I won't say it every time. When he offers his take, everybody listens. And by definition, this is sort of then the gold standard. This is the kind of popular opinion because you could always say, well, Magnus said this. So, you know, why are you like purple elephant 23, like disputing what Magnus said on Reddit or online, or even as another GM who offers like a contrary take, you're like, well, you're lower rated than Magnus and Magnus said this, like, what do you know? How many world championship matches have you played? And I think it's very important to point out that with certain questions, just because you are the highest rated player on the planet, it doesn't mean that the science on that question is settled. Like, for example, in the case of speculating about preparation, there was like that game which Gukesh won to level the score. Again, I won't try to remember which game it was.
I think it was three, yeah.
Game three, okay. So it was loss, then a draw, then a win, where Ding's bishop got trapped on c2. There was sort of a mini debate about where Ding's preparation ended. And if he wasn't in his prep, like, why would he play the move bishop c2 when there was a perfectly viable alternative in stepping the bishop away? And I don't remember, like, where Magnus stood on that topic, but I do remember that, like, Hikaru was very adamant that, no, bishop c2 was preparation. I personally thought, you know, I erred on the other side of the coin that I don't think it was preparation. But I want to like point out that there are still topics where it's okay as a chess fan, I think, to like not have the same intuition that Magnus has. And I would agree with Dubov, I think, in seconding the point that, yeah, like when Magnus says something, I think there can be a tendency in the chess world to just assume that the debate is, there is no debate to be had. Like whatever Magnus said is gospel. And I will be honest with you, Ben, I did not watch any recaps in their entirety for the entirety of the match. Like Jan Hamishi did a longer recap in Russian and some of them were pretty informative. And again, people hear that like Jan, like of course Jan and I have had our differences, let's say, but I, you know, still like it's good to hear some of the top players' insights. Other than that, I like once I commentated the games, I didn't want anything to have to do with them. Like I wanted to wipe the slate clean. I was sleeping for most of the day. And then when I woke up, it was time to join the call for the next round. So if there's any like specific things that Dubov mentioned, I can comment on them. Sorry. I feel like that was very disjointed. That was
no, but I mean, it's a tricky issue because it's like a first world problem. You know, it's great to have the world championship weigh in, but I did sort of get what he was saying. But I mean, if you ask me personally, I would rather hear what Magnus has to say. And obviously well,
yeah,
like, it gets,
yeah, I think it's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
Gone.
And it gets a little echo chambery, you know, when like Maria, who was doing her job and did a good job, Maria Emelianova, sorry, Maria, if I said that wrong, asks Gukesh, like, what did you think of this comment from Magnus about like the play being substandard or whatever it may be? But you know,
what I think of Gukesh's comment and Magnus's comment,
right? Exactly.
Like Dubov's comment and Fabi's comment.
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to follow up on from the tick recaps, which again, I thought were fantastic. I tuned in religiously, but mm-hmm. some people were saying that of course it's Magnus and Levy who have both, you know, been vocal in the past that they, mm-hmm. they think maybe the world championship format could use some tweaking, to put it lightly. Where do you come down on that generally? And did this particular match like sway your opinion in any direction?
Yeah. So like the first I remember of this debate was of course the candidates tournament in Madrid. And I was commentating it on site from Madrid and Magnus was present. Like there were rumors that Magnus might be here and you know how it is like, oh my gosh, like where's Magnus staying? Like, is he in Madrid? Was he spotted like in a restaurant? And all the players were talking. And he was indeed in Madrid to meet with FIDE. Like that is when he started making his demands that like the format better be changed or else he might not play. And back then it was like sort of unthinkable that Magnus wouldn't play. Like, I'm like, well, how will the chess world recover, like, if Magnus doesn't play the next match? And, well, we recovered pretty well. I think the chess world cleaned up pretty well, and we still enjoyed the match. So, of course, like, I think most people would prefer for Magnus to play. And you can understand, sort of, you can hold these two thoughts in your head. Like, on the one hand, I can totally understand Magnus not wanting to go through the incredibly arduous preparation process, given the fact that the games are played in, like, a long classical time control. And that, like, the matches is a, like, 6-month undertaking just to prepare for it, particularly because Magnus would have a big X on his back. Like, people would take a match with him extra seriously, and he has, like, nothing to prove, blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, like, the World Championship has a pretty storied tradition of adhering to, obviously not one format, but, like, a set of formats that are pretty similar to each other, like classical time control, lots of rest days, like, a long preparation period. My question, though, to you is, has Magnus, like, made clear and like, made clear what exactly his demands are? And, like, are you asking, like, would I prefer to see a different World Championship format? Just to clarify, like, the question.
I believe that he has said in interviews in the past that he would prefer a mixed format, something along the lines of 4 classical and, mm-hmm. like, 6 to 8 rapid, and maybe even incorporate some blitz. So I guess...
What's the last? How about some bullet while we're at it?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of traditionalists groaning as they listen. And he's even said that the classical could be weighted more heavily, but yeah, something along those lines.
And I want to be very careful about, like, any inkling that I disagree with Magnus, but I respectfully, I mean, in general, like, with Fischer Random, I know he's all in on the what is he, a freestyle chess train. I wouldn't say Fischer Random hater, like a prediction hater. What do you not hate? I don't love Fischer Random. Like, I never found it to be as engaging as regular chess. I do think that there's a certain elegance to regular chess. So it's, I think, again, like, to come back to my earlier point, it's, there is room for different perspectives on these topics. And I do think that the World Championship should remain, like, classical time control for now, because I think this is the popular opinion of most chess fans. I think even the fans who think that rapid and blitz should have a bigger place as, like, a more prominent time control, and believe me, like, those people would be preaching to the choir. Like, I am nobody to shoot down the opinion that, like, the World Blitz Championship should be considered, you know, not on the same level as the classical World Championship, but it is a type of World Championship. Like, blitz is a full-fledged form of the game. Again, like, I'm preaching to the choir here, I think. Maybe the Bullet World Championship, I can understand why it remains in the shadows. But still, I think that because of the tradition of the World Championship, and because even what this match showed is borne out by the evidence, even, like, the classical chess haters, I think everybody can agree the games were plenty entertaining. I think that within the realm of classical chess, you can also have deviations in the time control. Like, for the U.S. Masters, they had my favorite classical time control. It's like saying my favorite type of vegetable. It's like, I prefer to play blitz, but if I'm playing classical, I prefer Dos Equis. Like, if I'm playing classical, I like 90 plus 30 for the whole game. 90 minutes with a 30 second increment and no time addition on move 40. Here, you had this newly popular thing, which I think was grouched about by certain GMs, the fact that increment only appears on move 41. I really like that because, yeah, I like the time scrambles. I think that it is the popular opinion, you know, that these time scrambles, they add another wrinkle to the player's time management. No, you can no longer have 1 minute for 10 moves. And if you do, yeah, you're going to get, like, moves being made really fast. I don't think we've had a single incident thus far of, you know, like, pieces flying and, like, the purity of the game being sullied. But it adds an interesting new wrinkle. So I just don't think that a mixed format World Championship would really catch on. I feel like we're not there yet. You know, if there's, like, a popular chorus of, okay, this is getting boring, it's all draws, and, you know, that line of thinking has existed for literally over 100 years. I can quote from a New York Times Capablanca article that I'll find momentarily, but truly, this is nothing new. I don't think we're at that level of desperation yet, and I would prefer to go at it from the other angle, for, like, the World Blitz and Rapid Championship to be elevated to a higher standard and maybe expanded, and for rapid and blitz tournaments to become kind of a mainstay with the participation of the top players, as opposed to melding everything together. I don't think it's a zero-sum game, if that makes sense. With the greatest respect to Magnus, and everybody who knows me knows that I am a proud card-carrying Magnus fanboy.
Yeah. I think the only... I agree, by the way. I mean, I found this match to be incredibly compelling and don't see much need to change. The only thing I would change is to have Magnus in it. But unfortunately, we can't have everything we want in life and totally understand his own choices. We'll be right back with more World Championship Talk with Grandmaster Daniel Naroditsky.
With an hour before boarding, there's only one place to go. The Chase Sapphire Lounge by the club. There, you can recharge before the big adventure or enjoy a locally inspired dish. You could recline in a comfy chair to catch up on your favorite show or order a craft cocktail at the bar. Whatever you're in the mood for, find the detail that moves you with curated touches at the Chase Sapphire Lounge by the club. Chase, make more of what's yours. Learn more at chase.com/sapphire reserve.
Cards issued by JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC. Subject to credit approval.
You can get the most important meal of the day any time of day. I'm talking about the $5 Big Deal breakfast meal from Jack in the Box, available all day and all night. A breakfast Jack with a freshly cracked egg, a hash brown, and French toast sticks for $5. Sounds good for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. At Jack, every bite's a big deal. Order Jack's $5 Big Deal breakfast meal now.
Hitting the road this summer? When you download the Fuel Forward app, you save up to 20 cents per gallon on your first fill-up at Phillips 66, Conoco, and 76 stations. Because that's what the app does. A simple, straightforward way to keep you moving forward. Fuel Forward. 20 cents is a combined savings of 5 cents every day off per gallon plus an extra 15 cents off per gallon for first-time users up to 30 gallons. Offer valid once for a new Fuel Forward app user through 12/31/2024. Participating locations only.
And one last thing on the World Championship, and it sort of ties into what we were saying, is the openings were less theoretical than they have been in the past. Do you think that's a trend that will continue?
Yeah, I remember discussing this on the, that's a great question, on the Mustreader podcast with Greg Mustreader a while back, after the Canada's tournament, actually, in Toronto, that there has been this shift where the draw death of chess, you know, it's been predicted forever and ever, but there has been a kind of subtle meta shift in opening strategy where we've realized with the advent of like seriously strong computers, you know, like the Stockfish 13s onward, that everything's a draw. And because everything's equal, that means that there's no longer really any sense in, you know, diving down the Nidorf tunnel, where if you look at, for example, the games from St. Louis 2005, not St. Louis, San Luis 2005, St. Louis, Argentina, with the participation of Topalov, I think it was the World Championship tournament back then. And so you had tons of Sicilians, and Peter Lecco played in that. You had Nidorf battles, and you might think that we've got the narrative backwards. Like if you saw the games from Kukash Ding, you would think that these might be games from like the 60s. Like they're deviating by move 7 or 8. They're out of known theory. But I think it's awesome. And I think The reason this is happening is because players have realized that, yeah, most likely chess is a draw, but it's okay that we've realized this because there is still plenty of room for exploration. And so now the goal of the opening preparation is no longer let's win out of the opening, which kind of top players became obsessed with maybe like 15 years ago, like this notion that you need to like gain a maximum amount of advantage. Now it's shifted to I need to make my opponent uncomfortable, or, you know, different side of the same coin. I want to get a position that might be equal or even slightly worse. And you see that a lot, by the way. Like you'll make rookie one, right, in that symmetrical Grunfeld's love. When you plug rookie one into the engine, it's like -0.2 or -0.3. Ironically, like in 2006, if such a move were made, the commentators be like, how could he do that? Deep frizz, look at the assessment. This is ridiculous. But now when you analyze more deeply, you realize that you get a much more uncomfortable position with black, even with the extra pawn. So this is this great paradox that as computers have gotten stronger, the opening innovations have more of a human watermark. Like you're trying to play this anti-computer chess, and that is the best way to fool your opponent rather than saying, my like massive engine, my server and my team is capable of like pressing the space bar more times than your team is, which of course at some point was a viable way of gaining an edge in the opening. There's that famous Kramnik-Lecko story in 2004 that I won't restate, right? The story of like Lecko's team leaving their computer on for longer, but that's a relic of the past because you can now like rent massively strong cloud engines. So you're not going to like out spacebar the spacebar masters. And it's great. I like to see, you know, One Knight F3 G3 is back, like the French is back. So some frontiers are closed because of computers, but others have opened. And, you know, you can't play the Latvian Gambit anymore in a World Championship match, or maybe you can, but you absolutely can play the French, and you can play openings that maybe have been closed off for the last 20 plus years because they've been considered to be too dubious.
Yeah, the French was like the end boss. You know, he trots it out early.
It's muted.
Yeah, White doesn't want to return to it. But finally, we got closure on that storyline towards the end. But
even
yeah,
the Scandi, like I look at some of these. Even the Scandi, it's like hard to get more than like 0.3 or 0.4. John Bartholomew will be very happy. He didn't pay me to say this, I promise. Right. And I'm not going to play it with black because it sucks. But it's still hard to refute.
Like, okay. Yeah, we're waiting crazy for John's course. Shout out to John Bartholomew. For the latest Scandi theory. Yeah, I agree. And yeah, the fact that Ding spent an hour before move five says all you need to know about like the opening. There's still some fertile ground, although obviously maybe some unique circumstances and some poor time management in that case, which brings me to one more World Championship topic, and then we'll hit a few other and let you go if you're okay, Danya.
Great.
Thanks. Really appreciate it. So chess improvement takeaways. I tried to get them from I Am Andras Toth. I feel like this was a uniquely challenging World Championship, but is there anything that you, for all the people listening at home, that you say we can definitely learn from these 14 games?
That's a great question and something that I'll continue to think about. So obviously small disclaimer, like I haven't, the meat has not cooked through. When I'm in commentator mode, like it's, I also try to offer like instructive points. But primarily, of course, my job is to narrate the course of events. And I have to sort of switch to a different lens through which to view the games, like the chess teacher lens. Well, first of all, okay, I would say that the newer player, okay, for a total beginner, I don't think that there are any improvement takeaways from, like, I don't think that the World Championship match is the, you know, the most nutrient-heavy set of games that you should be looking at. I'm just going to be honest. But for, like, the club player, intermediate player, or even, like, low-rated title player, sorry, I mean like NM or FM like compared to Magnus, I think that there's plenty to extract in the way of useful information. Like I would look at the biggest mistakes from the match, and I'm not talking like the piece blunders. It's, you know, it can be fun and cathartic to like dunk, oh, like even Ding like blunders a piece here, and that can be cathartic in the way of, not of like gloating about Ding or about Gukesh, but understanding that everyone's human,
yeah,
right? It's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. Like you see that even the players fighting for the world title, they are capable of having these mental slip ups. And I think for a lot of players, when they face higher rated opponents, the biggest obstacle is actually psychological. Like it's this, like, why do you trust your opponent? It's because deep in your mind, it's not so much that you don't trust yourself. It's more that you think your opponent can do no wrong. You're just not, it doesn't add up in your head that like this title player can possibly make a mistake that's in your mind so basic. And the reason that happens because the mistakes aren't really that basic. Like it's everybody blunders, truly. And you can see that borne out in this match. But I would kind of go through not just like the one move blunders, but the positional mistakes, like the moments mentioned in the recaps and in the commentaries, and see if you can just figure out why those mistakes were made. Like a great example is the move G6 by Ding in that aforementioned game 11, right? This is why I can be very critical of the narrative that the game is only lost because of the final blunder. Like move 15 of that game featured a moment that I thought was very instructive, where both players thought their position was much worse. So a good instructive exercise is like, okay, watch the press conference, see what the players said about the game specifically, which I know can be hard with some of the press conferences and all the questions to identify your favorite ice cream flavor, as Anish said, but then you can use the engine, see if you can like verify some of their conclusions and understand like, why do both players think they're worse in this position? Can I sort of figure that out? From White's perspective, I think it's pretty clear why Gukesh thought he was worse. That's first of all, because he was worse. And second of all, you know, because Black has like major control over the light scores, but why did Thing think he was worse? Like, can you analyze a little bit and see if you can understand what's behind the player's evaluation of the position? Learning from other people's mistakes in general, I think, is probably the single best way to approach any game analysis. I don't say this as a cynic, and I don't mean this in like a again, like a cynical way, like, oh, you know, there is no such thing as a brilliant game. Of course, like, you should understand why the good moves are good, but understanding why the good moves are bad is what prevents you from making those same types of moves in your own games.
The bad moves are bad, right?
Why the bad moves are bad. Sorry.
Yeah.
Good moves are good. The bad moves are good. The bad moves can be good for you. And I would say, yeah, go through the games with a fine tooth comb and focus not on the final blunders for some of them, but on the lead up. Like in the last game, can you understand how did Gukesh put Ding in a position where he was under 10 minutes? What were the decisions he made that you can learn from? Like, one super instructive moment I'll highlight is this very subtle move that didn't seem to do anything, but Leko and I, when we started to analyze, we understood how uncomfortable. Okay, he probably understood this within 2 seconds. Like, I understood this only after some digging. Okay, let me fast forward because all the moves in that game look the same. There, rook b2. This is actually what caused the bishop to land on a8, move 52. It was surprisingly difficult to choose a square for the bishop, and in the end game, sometimes making one move threats. I offer this advice often in my speed on one move itis, like, don't make a threat just because it's a threat. But the exception to that rule is these end games where you're trying to torture your opponent, where forcing them to make these micro decisions leads to decision fatigue very quickly, because every decision is going to have some drawback, real or perceived. And pretty soon your opponent can get really frustrated with that and end up making the wrong decision, such as rook f2. So those are some half-baked thoughts. And on my stream, I'll try to address that question a little bit more depth once I reflect on some of the games.
Yeah, no, well, that in itself is very helpful. Yeah, and this idea of Gukesh just constantly probing, and of course him being the younger player, and Ding eventually falling. I mean, I'm trying to put it gently, because I do think Ding. I mean, he put on a tremendous show and exceeded most people's expectations, and obviously total class act, as is Gukesh. So, Danya, I got a couple Patreon sub questions for you. Any final thoughts on the World Championship before we get to those?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a pleasure to cover the match. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that the time zone was favorable for, you know, the denizens of the East Coast.
Yes.
Or the, you know, North American subcontinent. The game started at 4 a.m. my time. It is pretty brutal to commentate in that time zone, because, you know, from the outside, it might seem pretty trivial to kind of change your schedule, and people think, oh, well, you don't sleep anyway. Yeah, but like at 4 a.m., I'm sort of winding down. I'm not like starting.
Yeah, that's probably your worst time, basically.
Like my absolute worst time, because that is actually when I usually go to sleep, around like 3, 4. I'm rarely up at like 5 or 6, like sometimes, but then I'm really winding down, or I'm just tilted and I've lost 200 points.
Right.
But yeah, this was really, really hard. And I did manage to mostly change my schedule. Like, I did get sleep during the day, but you're still sleepy at night. Like, that's not the way it works. I guess eventually your body adjusts, but I was, you know, like very, very caffeinated, and it was tough, but I also like do what I love. Like, I wouldn't be able at that hour to, like, I don't know, attend like a lecture, or, you know, like work some other job. You know, the only thing I'd be able to do is like get up for the airport or commentate chess, which is the only two things you should be doing at that hour.
Right.
And sleeping, of course. So I really hope the next World Championship will be at a slightly more favorable time zone. I have a story. I don't know. Okay, I guess the statute of limitations has passed on this, so I'll reveal this juicy tidbit.
Spicy, let's go.
Exclusively for Ben Johnson.
All right.
And the Perpetual Chess podcast. And again, I hope nobody holds this against me. Like, I paid the price for this, and I'm very lucky that this wasn't a bigger issue than it was. The secret that I'll reveal is I have overslept only one show in its entirety in my commentary career. And it annoys me sometimes that people, I have this like, and most people mean it very in a good natured way, but nevertheless, like I actually have a pretty good track record when it comes to making commentaries at crazy hours. But I overslept one show in its entirety, and that is the game 6 of Ding Nepo match. So that is the commentary that I chose to oversleep. I overslept a round of World Championship commentary. So what happened was I did the first, or was supposed to do the first six games in succession. And it, in my mind, back then as a less experienced commentator, I think the game started at 6 a.m. And you're like, okay, you're watching as Naroditsky digs himself into a hole. No, I think the game started at, I think, 6 a.m., which is maybe even worse. And first couple of games went well. It was all totally fine. And suddenly, you know, like by, well, not suddenly, by like game four or five, my schedule was getting worse and worse. Like I was sleeping less and less during the day. And I was like running on empty. And I remember after the fifth game, I went with my friends to dinner. And we were talking, actually, we were joking about like how funny it would be to oversleep a world championship round. I was like, imagine if like I come back home and I go to sleep instead of like staying up and covering the match. And game six was supposed to be three commentators. This is why I was so lucky, because game five was just, I think, me and Anish. Game six, the slated cast of commentators was Howell, Anish, and myself. And I came home and I was just so tired that I don't even remember getting into bed. Like it was just like a blank spot in my head. Like my, you know, your body just takes over at some point. And that's why like I feel like I can reveal this. Like I don't believe that it stemmed from a lack of responsibility. It just is really, really hard to change your schedule like that. And I should have realized that before the show. So the next thing I remembered, like I wake up and I look outside and it's light outside. And first I was like, oh great, you know, I feel pretty good. And then I'm like, wait a second, why is the sun up? Like the sun's not supposed to be up. Wait. Like we're supposed to start the show when the sun is down. And then it dawned on me, no pun intended, that that I had overslept the round. And I, of course, like the few moments after you oversleep something, not that anybody watching would have ever overslept anything, it's like you're immersed in this total sense of dread. I'm like, they're at my front door. I need to lock myself in this room forever. I'm not picking up my phone. And eventually I picked up my phone. And the funny thing is, like, my phone wasn't like flooded or anything. Like chess.com, to their great credit, understood immediately what was happening. They didn't like they didn't spam call me 20 times, because it was a day with three commentators. So Hal and Anish took over. They just let me sleep. And they're like, dude, like it wasn't a problem at all. Like we would have woken you up, you know, take time to rest. And I was like, I almost started to cry. Like I thought I was going to get fired. I was ready to like pay back all my salary. You know, I felt genuinely extremely remorseful, because for me, like it's really, really important to like, commentary is my job. People ask me like, what is your job? Like, oh, what do you actually do? My job is commentator. Like that is my primary, title. And so like, I take my job very seriously, and it's a great honor to commentate with the legends that I do. So anyways, like it wasn't a big issue. But had I done this on a round with two commentators, I think that everybody might have been singing a slightly different tune. As much as Anish likes to sometimes likes the sound of his own voice, I mean, so do I. But commentating solo is a pretty daunting undertaking. So yeah, that's the game I chose to oversleep, and all's well that ends well. So I'm really happy that this time around I approached it with a little bit more discipline. I had more energy, and it was still so much fun to cover the games. I had a great time. I had a blast.
And I got to ask, Danya, is there alcohol involved in this story?
Is there alcohol involved in the story? Oh, like on the night beforehand?
Yeah.
I think I might have had a glass of wine. We went to a Spanish restaurant and I had paella. I was in such a good mood. I mean, I was in a good mood partially because when you're that sleep deprived, you're just like in this like state of weird like euphoria almost. And I should have picked up the warning signs and messaged my producer, like, dude, this is going to be a car crash. And I'm actually glad that I didn't commentate, because I think I might have let some things slip. Story has a happy ending, and I'm very happy that I was entrusted to do a lot of the commentary for the next match. But I'm exhausted. Yeah. Like, this shit was hard, and I'm just, like, taking the next week and retreating to my cave. Well, and I will go outside a little bit. But yeah, I'm in self-care time for sure.
Well deserved, and as I mentioned, you guys did an amazing job. Let's get to some listener questions. So first up, from Roy Lopes, thanks for helping to support the podcast. Yeah, that's his real name.
I'm glad he plays chess.
Yeah, exactly, and that's with an S, not a Z. But nonetheless, shout out to Roy, and he asks, he says, I'm a huge fan of your content and thrilled to see the speedrun series back. I had a couple of quick questions, and we'll take them one at a time. Number one is, any chance we'll see you on Chessable soon?
Yeah, first of all, I think I got a letter from him to the Chess Center. And so if indeed that is the same Ruy Lopez as opposed to, I don't know, a different one, or next I'm going to get a letter from like Juco Piano.
Greco.
Like, all right. And then whatever E4, E5, Bishop D3 is called. Bishop keeps retreating back to C8. I had to say at least once, yeah. You know. So I am working on a King's Indian course. And I do get this question a lot on my stream, like, when's the course coming out? It's been an opus magnum. That was actually a slip of the opus magnus.
You even do puns by accident.
Yeah, that's how I have a stage five pun disease.
Right.
So I started working on this project. It's been like over a year now. And I quickly realized that, and this is going to be like my first and probably my only Chessable course. Not only is the amount of work vast, but I am a horrible perfectionist and procrastinator, which often goes hand in hand.
Right.
But this is not a project that I'm procrastinating on. I have been working on it continuously, literally for a year and a half. And
wow.
At the risk of sounding or pedestalizing this, I will say that people really need to see this in a wider context. Like, sometimes a book can take an author 5-6 years. Like, I don't know how long Stephen King spent writing The Stand, which I did read in its entirety. I feel like now I'm gonna Google this and like, oh, David Foster Wallace wrote Infinite Jest in like 2 seconds.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised, but I'm your mortal. I'm sitting on a lot of chairs, so to speak, and I'm doing a little bit at a time. And the hardest part actually of the King's Indian project has been the annotations. My vision for this course is I want a course that, first of all, somebody can purchase without the video component and reap like not as much benefit from it. Like, there will be a video component, and I hope to make the video component like be the cherry on top. But I'm like basically writing essays on like every move. I'm really passionate about this being the best course ever written, not from the perspective of, oh, look, I got Narodisky and I did best opening course. And you're Sam Shaklin and your course is worse than mine. Like, it's not from a competitive standpoint, but because the King's Indian is my first love when it comes to chess openings. Like, it's the opening that I've played for the longest. I'm super pumped at a lot of the ideas that I found in collaboration with Grandmaster Bortnik, who's been of invaluable assistance in the analytical component of this course, and I'll give him the proper credit. But this is, you know, I'm not doing this for the money. And I mean this genuinely. Like, this is not, if I was doing this for the money, the course would have been released like 6 months ago. At this point, it's a passion project. And my calculus is, yeah, maybe I'll be one of those stories of, you know, the guy like founds a startup that's promising, and then he keeps fine tuning and releasing beta versions until it becomes irrelevant. But I don't think the King's Indian will be irrelevant like 6 months from now. So if it takes me another, like, I would estimate it will take me another couple of months at least. I'm going to be realistic here to release this course. But I'm just not willing to do it until it meets my standards. I have like maybe 2 or 3 more files to annotate, and then part one is ready, and then work can begin on part two. But this is not something I'm ever going. I think this is the only Chessable course I will ever release. And I want this to, like, I want to make this one count, so to speak.
Excellent.
But the answer is yes. The short answer is yes.
Yeah. I mean, well, King's Indian, obviously, for the same reasons you mentioned, has a lot of diehards. So I'm sure that it will be a must get when it's ready. And Roy's other question, he is Portugal based, is, do you have any events planned in Europe for 2025?
No. So my only planned event is the World Rapid and Blitz. So no, but asterisk, I don't have any events planned in 2025. And I definitely, there's a couple of trips that I want to make just for personal reasons. Like, I wanted to make it to London. I have some friends to see there. I wanted to make it to Italy. Unfortunately, I'm missing a trip with my mom to Italy during World Rapid and Blitz. I hate the scheduling of that tournament.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when the hysteric paranoia was at its peak, one of the criticisms was like, oh, you know, like, how dare you say that like Christmas time is the time that you spend with your family? Like, you're not flying to Samarkand to play the World Rapid and Blitz. So it was not an easy decision for me. But how, you know, how many times is this going to be in New York? Like I have to, it's a 40-minute flight from Charlotte. So
yeah,
I'll definitely be in Europe at some point in 2025. I've never been to Portugal, and I heard many great things about it. I'm a big fan of just food in general, exploring food of different cultures. Probably can't make it to Portugal without a degustation of the finest Porto wine. I think that's where port comes from, if I'm not mistaken. Porto, Portugal. So I've had friends who've had rave reviews, so hopefully I'll make it to that corner in 2025.
We'll be right back with more World Championship Talk with Grandmaster Daniel Naroditsky.
This year, Santa's bringing the power of Energizer into his workshop.
Whoa, the Energizer Bunny's got so much power.
Wait, he's powered up all the toys. I think that means we're done for the year.
I love this bunny.
He's the hardest working helper the North Pole has ever seen. And he wants all your gifts to have the power of the number one longest lasting AA battery. So this holiday season, stock up on Santa's and the elves' favorite battery, Energizer Ultimate Lithium.
Meaningless stuff. Why do we gift so much meaningless stuff? Tired of generic gifts and hollow trends? Shutterfly allows you to create meaningful photo gifts for your family and friends. Whether it's a cozy fleece blanket for grandma, a stunning canvas print for mom, or a mug to make dad smile. Enjoy 40% off with code MAKE40 at Shutterfly.com and make something meaningful this year. See site for more details.
Hey, it's Bill Simmons from the Bill Simmons Podcast here to tell you about Michelob Ultra Courtside. It's getting fans closer to the NBA with a chance to win prizes like courtside seats, a trip to All-Star Weekend, and much more. Check it out at MichelobUltra.com/courtside. Michelob Ultra Superior Access, courtside 24-25 sweepstakes, no purchase necessary. Open to U.S. residents 21 and up. Begins on October 1st, 2024, ends July 1st, 2025. Multiple entry periods. Visit MichelobUltra.com/courtside for free entry, entry deadlines, and official rules. Message and data rates may apply. Void where prohibited.
Excellent. And yeah, obviously, as a fan, I'm super excited that you're playing in the World Rapid and Blitz. And we weren't sure how much we were going to discuss this ridiculous, these, you know, unfounded accusations against you. But I will ask, did the accusations factor in your decision? Like when I interviewed you and Ludwig Hammer recently, he was saying the accused, people like yourself, it doesn't hurt for them to show up at these IRL tournaments. Did that impact your decision to play the World Rapid and Blitz?
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest here, and I don't want to touch any nerves or offend, you know, Jan Ludwig or anybody, but I'm going to be very firm and no issues, by the way, like for anybody watching. Like I said at the conclusion of the CSERT podcast that I'm sort of turning the chapter, but it's I'm a practical person. It's not like, okay, how dare you bring up like this thing that has dominated my life for an entire month? Like, not at all. I'm happy to talk about it. It's more that I don't like want to keep repeating myself, but this is something that hasn't, like, I've never gotten this question. It's a great question. And I feel strongly about it. So I apologize in advance. I don't mean this, nothing personal, to quote some of the luminaries, nothing personal, just sort of clarifying my stance here. First of all, there's a funny thing that happens where I'll play an OTB event and it kind of gets hushed up. And I feel like the people who are promoting this line of thinking, and unfortunately Kramnik wasn't entirely mendacious when he said that, you know, some of the top players are not revealing their stance behind the scenes. I think that the vast majority of top players are regular thinking people. A lot of them I've played in casual OTB Blitz, and this is what's crazy about this. Like, even this past weekend in Washington DC, I played like probably 5 hours of OTB Blitz and Bullet per day. I played Caden Trove, who came with us. I played Mykola Bortnik for the first time OTB. And literally, and a lot of the top players I played OTB, and anybody, like, when asked, will, like, I actually enjoy OTB Blitz more than online Blitz. This is the hilarious thing. I think I'm actually better at OTB Bullet and OTB Blitz than I am at online Blitz and Bullet.
Right.
And I used to be the one who would say to myself, of course, like, okay, let's see what happens when we play an OTB Blitz match. And suddenly it's like, now, like, the narrative has flipped entirely and I'm supposedly an onliner. The thing that I don't like is that, for example, I played the US Masters Blitz and I didn't get to play Fabi, but I tied for first with Fabi in Brewington. And this was not, I think, under the definition of like a farm tournament. This was the US Masters Blitz, I beat a bunch of IMs. I beat Ariantari in the last round, and I was really proud of my play. And I'm not going to lie, it felt really good. It felt validating. But one or two of these top players told me something similar, like, oh, it really won't hurt that you're playing in New York. And I hope to see a good performance from you, or like something along those lines in like a very remotely threatening way. And I won't name any names. They didn't mean it threateningly. I understand that. But this leads me to the conclusion that if I dare to have a bad tournament, a lot of other players, Sasha Bortnik, he told me that like your first World Rapid and Blitz, it's going to be nerve wracking. Like you're going to arrive in the playing hall and it's like, holy shit. Like that's Magnus. Like that's Nepo. That's freaking, like Gukesh might play. And I'm already like salivating with excitement. That was one of the reasons I'm so excited to play in the World Rapid is to circle back to what I said at the start of the podcast, I'm a fanboy. I love these guys. And looking at them is already like, whoa. Mm-hmm. I used to do this with my dad. Like when we visited like the Tall Memorial, and those were the first two super GMs that I met, Kramnik and Lekko. Because they were playing that day, I would just like point up, that's Ivanchuk. My dad's like, yes, I know, like quiet down. That's Vasily Ivanchuk.
Yeah.
And I'm still like that. I still have that side of me. To get to the crux of the issue, I am not like guaranteeing a good tournament. And I think it is ridiculous the amount of people, some GMs, and with greatest love and respect to Jon Ludvig, this line of thinking that like, oh, I'm glad you're playing in New York. I really hope that you play well, because if you have a bad tournament, like it justifies the continuation of this absurdity, this farce, is itself a deeply farcical comment. Like what gives any other top player the right to anoint themselves the secret police of like the chess world, and to say that like this particular tournament, this one day of Blitz, if not performed to like our expectations, capital O, like royal we, is then going to justify like continuing to put you in the spotlight. The reason I was so adamant about this in the C-Squared podcast is because I feel very strongly that that is like a completely unacceptable line of thinking. I think that those players should focus on, their own tournaments. And even if I didn't play New York, like Jospim is not playing in New York.
Right.
And I've been very firm, like people asking on my stream, even with the best of intentions, like, oh, is it weird that Jospim doesn't play in New York? Like, what's he doing during that time? It's none of anyone's fucking business. Like it's his decision entirely. And even if he didn't play another OTB tournament for the rest of his life, to demand that as a prerequisite of lifting these suspicions is completely unacceptable. And I wish more people called it out. So I'm excited for New York. Yes, like this weird spotlight of my performance in these 13 games, it has sullied my excitement a little bit. And in the darkest times, I've considered like dropping out, because I've never marketed myself as a professional Blitz player. Like I'm playing in New York for fun. It's a vacation for me.
Yeah.
I'm staying in New York an extra 2 days. I just haven't been to New York in many years. So I have zero like ambition. Of course, like I will take this very seriously. I will apply maximum effort. I hope to win the tournament, but I really, really wish that people would like not think of it in this light. Like if I have a bad tournament, I won't have anything to justify, and asking for me to justify it is like pretty ridiculous. So I hope that people can move on from that. That's kind of what I'd say.
I agree. And did just want to clarify one thing for listeners. It wasn't Danyo. It was me who said that I was going to try not to talk about the cheating stuff before we started. It wasn't Danya. And it was just because I feel like it's, as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, I feel like it's gotten way too much airtime to begin with, given that the allegations are unfounded. So that's why I wasn't interested in harping on it. But I did find this particular angle interesting, and I'm glad that Danya addressed it, and couldn't agree more that, one's reputation is not contingent on how they do in one tournament. I'm just excited to see people like Danya and Eric Rosen and all of the top dogs playing in New York. Next question, Danya, from supporter of the pod, John Rockefeller. Thank you for helping.
Oh, hey, John.
I had a feeling you guys had met. Thank you for helping to support the pod, John. And he says, you've been a coach in Charlotte Chess Center's team room at several of US Chess's Scholastic National Championship. What is that like? And do you have any favorite memories? Chips. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually why I didn't commentate like a couple rounds in the middle of the tournament. It's because I was at the grade level nationals, and it's become a tradition for me and Peter Giannatos. And this time we had Caden analyzing the games too,
GM Caden
to go Truff, along with a lot of the kids at the Charlotte Chess Center. And to analyze their games, we have a team room, and you know, we just have a lot of fun. I get to explore a new city. And no, it's like it was just as good as it always is. It's a road trip for us. We go by car. And it's like, I don't need to do this. It's not part of my like job with the Charlotte Chess Center. I do this because I'm really passionate about helping to foster the chess culture in Charlotte. You know, I really enjoy spending that time playing OTB Blitz with a lot of the other coaches who are there as part of like some of the New York teams, et cetera. But yeah, it was a really fun time. I wouldn't single anything out in particular, but it was as good a time as all of the other previous grade levels and all of the other previous nationals. I'll try to make it to Spokane, Washington next year, even though it's a little bit of a further trek. But I really appreciate John's help in putting all of this on.
Yep. So last question, we got to get on the record for people who have wondered, myself included, Daniel, what happened with the New York Times column, the chess column that you briefly did?
Yeah, like I had a great time doing it. It was nothing nefarious happened. If I'm totally honest, I think that it was a slight question of misalignment of expectations, whereby like I put in a tremendous amount of honest work in some of those early articles and puzzles. And I think I don't want to throw New York Times under the bus. Like it was an honor to work with them. Like, let me be totally clear. This is not like a politically correct driven answer. It's the truth. Like, from my perspective, like the marketing of the column and the distribution of this column was the sort of job of the New York Times. And I felt like from their perspective, I was not doing enough to sort of propagate this to the masses. But I kind of considered my job to be, okay, I'm putting these puzzles out, I'm sending it to you. And like, your job is to sort of like, make sure that it gets to, the readers. But I think that they believe that I should do more to tap into like my streaming audience and my YouTube audience. And I wasn't doing that enough. And I'm very bad at like marketing. I'm not a marketing expert. I'm not a PR expert. And it was a little bit disappointing to me that like that became an expectation that was put on my shoulders. And it was never supposed to be more than like a trial thing to begin with. Like that was in our contract. Like I did not sign a long-term deal. The initial deal was, we're going to do this for 3 weeks. We're going to see how it goes. And if, you know, it doesn't take off, then it's been great to work with you. Like, we'll go our separate ways. And that's what ended up happening. And like, my relationship to them is still fantastic. And I hope to have the honor of doing more work with the New York Times later on. So it was nothing nefarious. In the end, I'm actually pretty happy because at that point in my life, I was like way overburdened. So I don't think I would have had the bandwidth to continue that column. And I, you know, some people are like, hey, why aren't you doing this? And like, why aren't you doing that? And I'm happy that I'm still like operating within the chess sphere. And I'm sure that I'll have more opportunities in the future. But yeah, it was nothing nefarious.
Okay. Well said. We do miss it, but that's totally understandable.
I appreciate it.
And they do have an audience, you know, they have an audience on their own, the New York Times, believe it or not. But Danya, we know you got to go. Just want to say thank you for taking the time and thank you for the amazing coverage. You're on a short list of people, you know, recent accusations notwithstanding, that is quite like rightfully beloved in the chess community. So we appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's been great to be on your podcast. You ask the best questions. And I'm happy to come back anytime. A big shout out to all the chess fans who watched the World Championship and supported me. It's been an honor of a lifetime. I hope to cover the next World Championship as Gukesh defends his title.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Can't wait. Should we get your popcorn ready on slow boil?
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Danya.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
The Save on holiday essentials with digital coupons at Safeway. This week at Safeway, get Hass avocados for just 87 cents each with digital coupon. Limit 4. Plus, get mega packs of bone-in USDA choice beef New York strip steak for $6.97 per pound with digital coupon. Limit 2. Also this week at Safeway, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, 7-Up, or Dr. Pepper 12 packs of 12-ounce cans or 8 packs of 12-ounce bottles are buy 2, get 2 free, plus CRV, when you buy 4 with digital coupon. Visit Safeway.com or head in-store for more deals.